convicted of a crime of violence.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll bring you to order the meeting of the Public Safety, Security, Policy, and Finance Committee and start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine.
Here.
Representative Dean. Representative Frankie. Representative Grossel.
Here.
Representative Howell. Representative Lomer.
Here.
Representative Lucero. Representative Neuberger. Representative O'Neill.
I'm here.
Representative Pinto.
Here.
Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Zerwas.
Okay, we'll entertain a motion for approval of the minutes for March 16th.
So moved.
Representative Considine moves the minutes of March 16th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, if there's any overflow, room 181 has been set aside for extra people. The first bill up is House File 1779. Representative Hertaus will move your bill for possible inclusion. And would you like me to move your amendment also, Representative Hertaus?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good to see you all, my colleagues.
Want me to move your amendment?
Yes, that'd be good.
Okay, the chair will move the H1779A1 amendment to get it in the shape that the author would like. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, Representative Hertaus, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, thank you. I thought you had moved the amendment already. Well, members, what I'm introducing today is a bill about collateral consequences. In Minnesota, we have pretty much a practice of not locking people up, but providing extended periods of probation. And also of concern is a general trend that's been going on not only in our state but nationally about the consequences of stays of adjudication and what people suffer as a consequence when they maybe don't fully understand the consequences of entering into plea deals and collateral consequences of that. And so with that, I'd just like to share a little bit of an overview of information. In 1974, about 1.8 million people, or about 1.3% of the adult population, had been imprisoned at some point of time in their life. By 2001, that number rose to about 5.6 million people, or about 2.7% of the adult population. And the Department of Justice estimates that if in the 2001 imprisonment rate remains unchanged at about 6.6%, of Americans born in 2001 will serve prison time during their lives. In addition to those who have served prison time, an even larger proportion of the population has been convicted of a criminal offense without going to prison. And according to a 2003 Department of Justice report, nearly 25% of the entire population of the United States, some 71 million people, have a criminal record. Now, there's real concern that collateral consequences may impose harsh burdens on convicted persons, that they will be unable to really reintegrate into our society. And so the Uniform Collateral Consequences of Conviction Act is promulgated by the Uniform Law Commission that was established in 2009. And members, it really is an effort to improve public and individual understanding of the nature of the problem and to provide a modest means by which people who suffer from these disabilities may, under appropriate circumstances, not in every circumstance, but under appropriate circumstances, gain partial relief from these disabilities and to reenter our society as productive taxpaying citizens. With that, I would like to introduce Mr. Mark Hasse to make a few comments about his experience in this arena of collateral consequences.
Sir, with your name and title, and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Hasse, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Prior to lobbying for the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, I worked for an organization called the Council on Crime and Justice for about 7 years, and there I worked in the area of policy around criminal records and collateral consequences and directly with individuals who, after they had been convicted of a crime, completed their sentence, they were trying to get employment and housing. And I can tell you that from that experience, that was very difficult. And I know you in this committee have heard much about this over the years, the barriers that are put up for people after they've done everything that they are expected to do. In fact, if you look at the appendix in the bill, you'll see all the places where all the different statutes exist saying, you know, who can do what based on certain backgrounds and certain occupations. And some of those may be appropriate. I don't think that all of them are, but many of them probably are. Turning to the bill before you today, what's left after the amendment are basically two key provisions. The other provisions in there, the criminal defense lawyers would support. They offer some actual new remedies for some of these sanctions. But the two main provisions that are left in the bill are a notice provision and a provision that requires a listing of all the sanctions that exist, including an online listing. So to the notice piece, over 95% of criminal convictions are arrived at through a plea agreement, an agreement, which is an agreement between the government and a citizen. And I think we can all agree that when a citizen enters into an agreement with their government, they should know what the consequences of that agreement are. That should be a transparent process. They should know what they're bargaining for. Currently, that just is impossible. It just does not happen. It's very difficult. There's a statute that does list all these sanctions, but as you know, somebody finding a statute who's not an attorney or not a legislator, that might be something they wouldn't do. So what this bill does in its current form is to require that people are given notice that there will be additional consequences based upon their conviction, the thing that they're agreeing to, and provide them a website where they can go to find all those. And then they can have a real informed discussion with their attorney and maybe others about how they want to proceed based on that. Other provisions of the bill that are currently deleted out, which, you know, maybe there's another day for that, would allow some narrow remedies for some of those sanctions based on the circumstances of the case. But we do think that the notice and the information being out there is very important. We think that's something that everybody should agree to, is important. And so that's why we support the bill in its current form. Thank you, Representative Hurtas.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I also have Mr. Johnson, a retired attorney from Anoka County.
Go ahead, throw up your name and title and begin.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Bob Johnson. I'm the retired Anoka County attorney. I was in that position for 28 years, seven terms. So, and I was also the past president of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and the past president of the National District Attorneys Association. And very briefly, I'll share with you an experience I had that's going to face all of you at some point. You know, when I was turning over my presidency of the National District Attorneys Association, we had kind of a policy. So the day after you become the past president, the director would walk up to you and I would say, hey, Newman, you know, the guy I've talked to for the last year at least once a day. And Newman would look at me and say, what's your name? So I'm afraid that's what all of you are going to face at some point in time. Maybe not Chairman Cornish, but most of the rest of you. So I got into this issue in the 90s when I used to see things in my office that troubled me a lot. I'll give you one of the big examples. Was I had two Chechens that had stolen over $100,000, and they were going to be deported, not something you guys can do anything about. But that was the life back then. And so they admitted they'd done it. So the judge gave them a stay of adjudication, and I appealed that and reversed her. So came back to the court, and I couldn't get a new judge at that point. So they tried again, and she gave them a continuance for dismissal, and I appealed that and reversed her. So the defense attorney, being no dummy, said, okay, here's how we're going to do this. We're going to withdraw our plea, which she let them do, and we're going to try it to the court, to her. And she obviously knew they were guilty. I mean, they'd pled twice. So we tried it to the court, and I knew what was going to happen, and it did happen. She found them not guilty. So, you know, I was facing that with a number of judges where, because of their view that was reasonably put to them by the defense counsel, what was going to happen to them, we had a hard time with conviction, so we would search around for something else to convict them of that didn't have the same collateral consequence. And we did that in a number of cases. You know, one of the cases that presented a particular problem was domestic assault. And if I had a peace officer, you know, that was going to impact their job if they were convicted of domestic assault, because then they couldn't carry a weapon. And it was also an issue with regard to a lot of other crimes at that time. I think it may be changing now, maybe to some degree with this bill, but it used to be if you're convicted of a crime of violence, you had a lifetime ban against carrying a weapon. And actually, I testified on that, and I supported that because we'd had some real violence in Columbia Heights that had some deaths involved. And I thought a lifetime ban was appropriate, but then what I managed to convince the author to do was to put in an escape valve where they could, after they'd done their time, they could come back to the court and ask for relief from that ban. And that went through, that for many years then there was this ban on carrying a weapon, so you couldn't go pheasant hunting, you couldn't go practice shooting, I mean, you couldn't own a weapon, couldn't carry a weapon with you. So I felt I'd gotten that addressed, but then you're back to the problem of, you know, we'd have cases come before us, and as prosecutors we had two primary issues. I mean, the primary one was a charge by all of our standards, both the NDAA and the ABA, to do justice. So, you know, if I knew a person was going to get hammered by this collateral consequence, and that I thought it was not just, I felt I had something to do to try to figure out how we could convict them of something that wasn't going to impact them in the way that collateral consequence did. So we would come up with all sorts of other crimes, because as you guys well know, a course of conduct probably involves a number of different crimes. So we would take an assault case and convict them of terroristic threats or something else. Or you would convict a drug offender, which was a crime of violence at that time, and convict them of something that wouldn't impact their ability to carry guns. And so I was battling with that. And then the other piece that came into play in the late 90s, early 2000s, was Attorney General Reno had figured out and started to move forward on reentry. It's a term you've probably heard, that you know, prosecutors have a responsibility to try to protect public safety, and one of the best ways of doing that is to improve the chances of recidivism, the chances that they won't recidivate, so they won't commit another crime. And, you know, as I got to thinking about it, if you can't get a job, you can't find a place to live because you've got all these barriers, you know, you don't need a license to go out and sell drugs, you don't need a license to burglarize a house. So if you're trying to figure out how to make a living and how to support your family, it just made sense to offer them some way of making their way forward in this life. So we had, you know, I even sat down, a number of you have been around for a while, probably remember Campion, who wasn't exactly a weak heart. He was pretty tough, and he was sitting in my office because I used to be the chair of the Financial Crimes Task Force. Mm-hmm. And Campion was talking to me about this truck driver who was going to get bounced from his job after coming back from deployment because he had a criminal history on his record, and he was prohibited from driving a truck. And Campion said, you know, this just isn't right. And I, of course, agreed with him. But there really wasn't any option at that point. There wasn't any way to deal with that barrier to this guy, this veteran, coming back and keeping his job. So I got interested in collateral consequences and worked with the Uniform Law Commission to draft this uniform law and trying to move it forward to provide some avenue for a common sense approach to reintegrating offenders into the community in a common sense way. So that was why I got involved in this effort, and if you have any questions, I'm certainly happy to respond.
Okay, thank you, sir. Member questions? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really just want to comment and thank Representative Hertaus for bringing this forward. That, as a prosecutor, collateral consequences have been a concern of mine because they're outside of, you know, we focus on our criminal justice system on holding people accountable for what they've done, and there's a direct connection. I really would urge folks to look at the written comments provided by the county attorney, former county attorney Johnson. But I thank Representative Hertaus for bringing this forward because this is a really important thing for us to be working on. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other members? Any public testimony? Representative Hertaus, closing.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, when I first approached you about this early in the session, you expressed the certain components of the bill that really you found troubling, and I thank you for those comments, and the amendment offered basically gutted a lot of the disagreeable provisions of the bill. My main concern with where we're at right now, and thank you, members, for having this conversation about this issue, is to make sure that knowing that so many of our young people, particularly our prison population, 80% of those incarcerated are a population that centers around drug and alcohol abuse and or addiction. And to suffer the collateral consequences of being denied occupation or employment or housing long-term and not understanding sometimes what that means if you are signing a stay of adjudication and thinking that as a young person when you're in college you did something dumb and you sign here and you can avoid jail is of concern to me. So what this bill is really doing is providing a few stops along the way in any case being adjudicated that the individual has full disclosure and understanding about what those collateral consequences are going to be. And lastly, I just would like to make a point that I've been concerned about as well. As I've gone through my adult life, we continue to increase the number of our occupations that require a state license in order to get up in the morning and go to work. And with 34% of all trades and occupations now requiring a state license, what we find is about 34% of the jobs seem to be out of touch or out of reach for many of these people. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for listening to what some of the concerns are, and would like to continue working with you, and maybe the possibility that even this could be included in your omnibus bill with respect to the disclosure requirements so that people who do find themselves in an awkward position fully understand the consequences of what it means to avoid a few days in jail versus 7 or 8 or 10 years of probation, which ultimately sets them up for failure. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Hertaus. And with that, the chair will lay over as amended House File 1779 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Christensen, House File 1802. Representative Christensen, the chair will move House File 1802 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and go ahead however you'd like to proceed with your name and introduction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for moving House File 1802, a bill to create essentially a state supplement to a federal program providing nonprofit emergency management, nonprofit security grants for so-called soft targets that are vulnerable to terrorism. This bill would create essentially no work for the Department of Public Safety that they aren't already doing. They're already grading projects that are seen as vulnerable to terrorist attacks, and they forward those on to the federal government, which has a certain amount of money that they appropriate in the form of grants at a maximum of $75,000 per grant to protect soft targets from terrorist attacks. This the Twin Cities oftentimes is not a priority for Washington, and the Department of Public Safety identifies a lot of projects that they deem to be worthy, that the federal government just doesn't have time to, doesn't have enough money appropriated to fund, and doesn't necessarily always consider the Twin Cities a priority. So this bill would establish a program where we would supplement the grant money from the federal government and issue grants of this up to the same size and with the same guidelines and using the same grading system that the Department of Public Safety is already using. And to talk a little bit more about it, I have a couple of testifiers from the Jewish Community Relations Council.
Okay, whichever you'd like to begin with your name and title, and go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Lawrence Lon White. I am the Chief Counsel for Security and Resiliency at the Savis Jewish Community Center in St. Louis Park, and also advise on several other campuses that have Jewish facilities as well. I have almost 20 years of experience in the field of crisis management, global security, and homeland security. I'm a member of the FBI's InfraGuard program for public-private intelligence sharing, and a number of other related experiences and credentials in the field, and I'm honored to be here this morning to speak with all of you. In my experience in my career in almost 20 years, I have never seen anything quite like the environment we are currently operating in. I've had the opportunity to study events like Virginia Tech, Columbine, the shooting at Florida State, and I cannot tell you the impact the more than 150 bomb threats over the last 8 weeks have had on the Jewish community and the community in general, not just here in Minnesota, but around the country. We have a photo that we're going to pass around just to kind of sum up the situation. This is a photo that appeared in the Star Tribune the day of the bomb threat in St. Louis Park. It's a photo of three cribs that were in the snow on January 18th when infants were evacuated from the building.
I'll hold it up a little.
Absolutely. And we'll pass that around so everyone can take a look at that. The day of the bomb threat, we had more than 500 people in the Savis Jewish Community Center. It was a mix of infants, 3 months old, senior citizens, 100 years old, students going to class, special activity groups, special needs groups, developmentally disabled groups, Jews, Christians, Muslims, Indian Americans, African Americans. We're all in the building that day. It's not, it says Jewish in the title, but it's Jewish and community. And all of those folks were in our building and had to be evacuated. More than 500 people were safely evacuated that day. By and large, our plan worked. We got everybody out. The staff and faculty who was on campus that day did exactly what they were supposed to, and it worked well. The biggest challenge has been the emotional toll it's taken. For the last 6 weeks, I've spent much of my time meeting with parents, meeting with crying mothers, meeting with crying fathers. I never expected to have to do that. In my career, in almost 20 years of doing this kind of stuff, and I've been involved in hurricanes, I've been involved in earthquakes, I've been involved in natural disasters and aviation disasters and all kinds of bad things. I've never quite experienced anything like this before, and I've never had to provide that kind of emotional support that the community needs right now. I'm sure you've all heard on the news what's been happening around the country with these bomb threats. I will tell you, what you are hearing about is a tiny fraction of what is actually happening. Far more is being underreported in terms of threats, postcards, threatening emails, faxes, and calls. It is happening every day. And it cannot be understated how significant and meaningful this effort will be to offering our campus and the community overall the support for infrastructure, not just from a security standpoint, but from a resiliency standpoint, to help provide that sense of stability and help the community get back to where we want to be, provide that sense of peace of mind and that sense of reassurance that we're not in this on our own. I thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
My name is Anthony Sussman. I am the Director of Communications and Community Security at the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas. Thank you, Chairman Cornish and members of the Public Safety Committee, for your consideration of HF 1802 today. And thank you, Representative Christensen, for your leadership on this important legislation. On February 26, 2017, the Star Tribune ran a headline in the A section above the fold front page that said, anti-Semitic surge spurs fear and resolve. To underscore Lon's point, I have served as Director of Communications and Community Security at the JCRC for over 10 years, and I have never seen a headline like this in my career here. Since January 2017, there have been over 150 bomb threats targeting Jewish community centers, Jewish day schools, and other Jewish organizations throughout the U.S. and locally. As Lon mentioned, on January 18th, the JCC in St. Louis Park was targeted, and on February 20th, the JCC in St. Paul was targeted. I am sure that you share my concern that this is completely unacceptable. The Jewish community deeply appreciates the resources, expertise, and concern that local, state, and federal law enforcement have committed to addressing these disturbing acts. Just last week, the Minneapolis Division of the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the St. Paul Police Department held a briefing for the Jewish community to update us on the current investigation with regard to these bomb threats. As the organization tracking anti-Semitic incidents in Minnesota, the JCRC has seen an uptick in incidents reported to our office. There were 21 incidents reported to the JCRC in 2016, as compared to 12 in 2015. Already in 2017, there have been 9 incidents reported to our organization. To confront these threats, federal, state, and private resources are required. House File 1802 will help ensure Minnesota's at-risk nonprofit organizations will have the adequate resources to address these threats. As you may know, the Federal Nonprofit Security Grant Program is a bipartisan initiative that awards at-risk nonprofits up to $75,000 for target hardening activities. To qualify, nonprofits must demonstrate that they are at a high risk of terrorist attack. This money helps at-risk nonprofits purchase physical security enhancement equipment, inspection and screening systems, and in some cases, certain costs of training security personnel are also permitted. Each year, the Jewish Community Relations Council assists local Jewish organizations in a competitive process applying for these limited funds. As a community, we are grateful for those funds, but the Twin Cities area, one of 29 designated urban areas eligible for funding, is at a competitive disadvantage when compared to cities like Chicago, Washington, D.C., and New York City. Given the current threat environment, these funding opportunities will become even more competitive. This bill will bolster federal nonprofit security grant program with state funds. In Minnesota, as Representative Christensen stated, the Nonprofit Security Grant Program is administered through Homeland Security and Emergency Management, a division of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Minnesota's HSEM professionals already select the best local applicants to compete for these federal nonprofit security grants. Unfortunately, only a handful of Minnesota applicants receive funding each year. This legislation provides at-risk nonprofits that do not receive federal funding an opportunity to receive state funding for critical security initiatives. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, sir. Member questions?
Mr.
Representative Pinto.
I can defer to our lead first, Mr. Chair.
What's that?
I said if I can defer to our lead, Representative Hillstrom first, if you don't mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me first say that I'm so sorry that this is happening. It is unfathomable that the time that we are at in our country. I want to make certain that if we're going to do these, that we actually provide enough resources for the numbers that would be applying for this. Do we have any idea of what kinds of numbers of organizations might be applying for these kinds of grants to get a ballpark number of how much we would need to fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, the bill is drafted as a blank appropriation, and I think, you know, really any resources that we could put towards towards this would be very helpful in supplementing the federal program. You know, in the grand scheme of things, these grants are a maximum of $75,000, but these grants can make an incredible difference towards the organizations that they're granted to. As far as how many worthy grants are rejected per year, I think Anthony would probably have more information on that, as well as the Department of Public Safety.
Yes, typically within the Jewish community, anywhere between 10 to 15 organizations apply. In my time at the JCRC, I have seen some years zero nonprofits granted the money, and some, as the maximum I've seen, is three nonprofits being granted the money. So it's very competitive.
I will add, in an effort to be as effective as possible with the funds that are available, obviously a lot of nonprofits involved here, it's been very important to bring a sense of pooling of resources and knowledge and information sharing, intelligence sharing, so that the entire community is connected. We had a briefing with the FBI last week. We had behavioral analysis training for all members of the community. So it's been very important to bring people together so that we're able to leverage as much of the resources as we can, given what's available.
Representative Hillstrom, go ahead, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I too, support this proposal, and I believe that we need to do what we can to make certain that we are providing the resources necessary if the federal government is not. I look forward to having further discussions about how big this number should be to make certain we include all that should be included.
Thank you. Representative Dean. Representative Pinto, and then Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I represent the district that includes the St. Paul JCC, and I'm honored to be on the bill, and was honored to stand on the House floor when those threats were made there. And I thank you all for your work. And I will say to members that, as the testifier said, the JCC in St. Paul, anyway, I know the one in St. Louis Park as well, Sabus, is it really is a home for folks of all different backgrounds. My family's members for years and years. We're Catholic, and you look around and you see people of all different backgrounds there. I just want to make sure to emphasize about the bill that, of course, there are other communities that have experienced, and we've seen this huge rise in anti-Semitic threats and attacks. Other communities we know have been targeted as well, and just to emphasize that these grants don't discriminate on the basis of any particular background or particular group. Any group that is under threat, as we know many are, can apply for these funds and receive the support as well. And I see nodding that we're in agreement on that. Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Pinto, thank you. There has been a tremendous outpouring of support for the Jewish community, both at the St. Louis Park JC as well as the JCC as well as the St. Paul JCC. So, from all faith communities in town, so thank you.
Okay. Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to add on to what Representative Pinto just asked, because, you know, there have been times in the recent past that our Muslim neighbors have been threatened with these type of things, and that they would have the opportunities to apply for these grants as well. As any really targeted groups that we're seeing more and more of these days. So I just want to, for the record, make that clear that this is encompassing of all faiths and all people and all organizations.
To that point, I'd like to add, after the bomb threat, there was an outpouring of support from the community of all backgrounds and all faiths. I'm not sure how widely known it is, but on Sundays, our facility is used as a church by a number of groups. The day of the bomb threat, the first call that came in to our campus was from a local Muslim organization offering their support, their resources, their facility. It has been a very major showing of solidarity from everybody. And we offer that same thing. We want the idea of reciprocity and mutual benefit to help everybody.
Representative Christensen, no more questions in the committee. Any closing statements?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. Thank you, Representative Pinto and Representative O'Neill, for co-authoring the bill with me. You know, I think this bill is about allowing Minnesotans to feel safe and allowing organizations like the like Jewish community centers and other organizations in our community that are providing great services to our community and providing a place for people to gather experience community together. And this bill allows them to feel safe while they're doing that and allows them to not live in fear and under threat of terrorism and allows them to experience that community together in safety. And I thank you for your consideration, Mr. Chair and members, and that's thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Christensen. With that, the Chair will lay over House File 1802 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Becker Finn, House File 2337. You may move your own bill for possible inclusion once you get to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would move that House File 2337 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Becker Finn. Go ahead, how you want to proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill came about after we heard the results first study earlier this session, and it became clear that we're currently very little programming is available for domestic violence offenders while they are incarcerated. And it's I believe that's truly a lost opportunity to intervene in the cycle of violence and to really get at the underlying cause of domestic violence, which is the thinking and behavior of the abusers. So I've been in ongoing discussions with Department of Corrections staff as well as the folks at Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. There's likely some tweaks that we'll have to make to the specific language to make it the most effective. But I think that this is a really good step. It's something new, but I think a necessary way to help prevent domestic violence. So essentially what it would do would set aside some funds so that the Department of Corrections can identify both the offenders most at highest threat of further violence and also figure out what kind of program is going to work best to help prevent that behavior. So, I'll stand for questions. I'm not sure if...
Representative Becker Finn, any questions from members? Any public testimony? Any closing statements, Representative Becker Finn?
I just want to emphasize that both Department of Corrections and Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women are supportive of this idea, and I'm really hopeful we can start to make some progress on this issue. And then thank you for those of you who've signed on. It's a bipartisan bill, and I think that's really important. So thank you.
If you want to renew your motion.
Renew my motion that House File 2337 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative O'Neill, House File 2176. Okay, Representative O'Neill, you may move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 2176 to be laid over for possible inclusion in your wonderful omnibus bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. And you may begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair and members, I am very excited to be with you today for this particular bill. This is something I've been working on for some time, and I've got testifiers with me that I'm very excited for you to hear from. This is something that I'm passionate about. I'm very excited about. As you have heard me say before, I have a bachelor's degree in applied psychology with a minor in chemical dependency and a master's degree in marriage and family therapy and a community counseling degree. And also, I've been on this committee since I've been elected. So it kind of pulls all of these different pieces of my life together. I also worked at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge in the past, and so I'm very proud to have them here. Members, what this bill does is it looks at what we have been talking about literally all session, and that is those that are nonviolent controlled substance offenders and having technical violations and ending back in the prison. And so what this bill actually does is take a look at those that are the nonviolent offenders for controlled substance, and if they're on probation or parole or supervised release, it takes a good look at them to say, is there something more we can do before we revoke that and send them back to prison? And as you recall, when DOC was here before, 64% are back in prison because of technical violations. 64%, which means only 36% have committed a new crime, 64% go back to prison because of technical violations. Now, out of the 8,037 that were admitted into the prison in 2016, that's a pretty substantial number. We're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of offenders that have had this revocation happen. So we started kind of brainstorming of how could we get at this, and I've been talking with DOC as well, who have been incredibly helpful to craft this legislation. I also want to thank the co-authors in the room on both sides of the aisle that have it. Representative Lomer was great. We actually went out to one of the Teen Challenge campuses and began to kind of percolate this idea and try to figure out what can we do to get at this technical violations issue, particularly with nonviolent drug offenders. So what we have done is in this bill, it's two major components. It's taking a look at those offenders that have had a technical violation, probably more than one if we're talking about a revocation, and saying, should we do a restructure? And if we can do a restructure and they're not a danger to the public, and two, that they're amenable to treatment, why don't we offer them something in the community, again, so they stay in the community? We all know how incredibly important it is that they stay in the community. They stay connected to their family. They stay connected to their resources. They stay connected to their job. So let's offer them a restructure. And it could be inpatient treatment. It could be outpatient treatment, but something that they hadn't gotten already. And interestingly enough, as I brought this idea up to DOC, they said, well, we've started to look at that. And so they're already organically moving in the direction of doing a restructure as opposed to revocation. So I'm very excited to bring this forth. So the second half of this is funding it, because what do we always say? Where is the funding? How are we going to pay for this? So there is a funding component. Right now there's a blank appropriation, and so I've gone to the chair and asked him, please, can we please fund this? And so hopefully as this budget comes forth, we'll see some funding for this. The funding mechanism is coming goes from the general fund to the DOC, and it will flow through as a grant. And there are nine other situations where they have flow-through grants. And so it's not common, but it's not unusual. So that is the essence of the bill. And from that, I'd love to have you hear from Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. Again, I worked back there in the early 2000s and have stayed connected throughout the years. And they can give you a little bit of a story of what can they do if they actually receive an offender.
Let's start with your name and title and begin.
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Walsh, and I'm the Vice President at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. I'm also the co-chair of the Minnesota State Initiative to Reduce Recidivism, and then I'm also on the March Policy Committee. I have a background, 28 years of working in or with corrections. So I just want to emphasize that there are effective community alternatives. I'm going to highlight Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, what we do, but I think the same could be said of other treatment facilities. First thing is that people say when they graduate from our programs is that it was harder than prison. And it's because it's actually more intensive. It actually causes you to look at your life issues and to address those. And, in fact, our clients will say it's the hardest thing that they've ever done, but also the proudest moment they've ever had when they graduate from our programs. One of the jokes they say is it's not called Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge for nothing. It's not called Minnesota Adult and Teen Easy because it's quite the challenge. And we have our structure and accountability is such where we've actually had judges say that we are the equivalent of putting someone in a correctional facility because of the structure and accountability. And we also, while someone who is there as a condition of probation and parole, we work very closely with the Department of Corrections and the other two correctional delivery systems on their other conditions of probation. And so we work in very close partnership with them. While they're there, they get what we call tri-occurring treatment because it's not just criminal thinking and behavior patterns. It's mental health treatment that they need and alcohol and drug treatment that they need while they are there. But I think they actually start to transform their characters and their lives while they're with us. As a result, we have partnered with the Minnesota Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services on an initiative to reduce recidivism, which means that we're systematically looking at all of our programs and services to align with the research on what reduces recidivism. And then we also have our own studies which support our effectiveness. Some large reports that have come out recently have said that we have better than 50% impact on reducing relapse and recidivism. And then it doesn't stop there. We move on to address those areas of their life that set them up to reoffend, which is criminal associates, job, housing, their family relationships, supports within the community, involvement in their in a faith-based organization of their choosing. So we address all those, and I have to say that we provide this for 1 year at less than the cost of a prison bed.
Okay. Ma'am, give your name and title and begin.
Gina Evans, and I'm the Community Outreach Director at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. I also serve as a steering committee member for the Second Chance Coalition, and I'm on the executive board for the Minnesota Corrections Association. I've been down here, and Chair Cornish and members of the committee, I've been down here and spoken on several different things over the last few years, and I don't feel like any of it hits as close to home as this bill. I have been to prison three different times after 15 years of IV meth use. All three of the times that I've been to prison were on sentences that would have been considered presumptive probation. For any of you that don't have a clear understanding of the sentencing guidelines, there are lower-level nonviolent offenses that are always a probation sentence, and you have to violate to end up in prison. My crimes were always level one and two severity. Most of them were fourth and fifth degree drug possessions and check forgeries that I committed to get money for drugs. I was a drug addict, a pretty serious drug addict. My first crime, my first prison sentence was a year and a day, and it was on a fifth degree possession. I got caught with 1/10 of 1 gram of methamphetamines. I couldn't pass a UA. Or I wouldn't call my probation officer, failure to contact, and I would get violated. So my first time I did 30 days, I did 60 days on a violation, then I did 90 days on a violation, and then they executed my sentence and I went to prison for 4 months. My second charge was for low-level check forgery. The sentence was 13 months. I did 30 days, I did 60 days, I did 90 days, and then I ended up doing 5 months in prison. My third trip to prison was a 21-month sentence. It was a little more serious of a crime. It was an auto theft. I did 30 days. I did 60 days. I did 90 days. And then they executed my sentence, and I did 10 months in prison. Do you know how many times I did treatment while I was in custody in the Department of Corrections? Zero, because I wasn't there long enough to complete treatment. Our system is broken. I just believe so strongly that had a bill like this been in place during that time, that I would have gotten out of that system 5, even 10 years sooner. I believe that I'm right where I'm supposed to be right now, but I just believe wholeheartedly that a bill like this is going to change our need for a private prison. It's going to change our need for more beds within the Department of Corrections. And so I plead with you guys to do the right thing. The inmates that we're talking about, the criminals that we're talking about, their public health issue called addiction needs to be addressed, and it will eliminate the need for the public safety issue. Thank you, Representative Cornish.
Thank you. Representative, that's it. Done for testimony, Representative O'Neill, and we'll take Representative Dean's amendment if you are.
Mr. Chair, I have no more public testimony of mine.
Okay, thank you. Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to be clear that this amendment is in no way meant to hinder the ability of the original bill that you've offered, Representative O'Neill. I think it's a wonderful bill, and I think it's time we've done that. My amendment, briefly, is a voter restoration bill, one of the things that I think are critical to reducing recidivism as well. Pro-civic behavior is something that engages individuals in the community and makes them less likely to be doing the types of things that might even send them back on a technical violation. That's why I'm offering it today. And I'm offering it today as an amendment because over the past 3 years in the House, we've been unable to get a hearing for this bill. It's had Republican authors, it's had Democratic authors, and it's had broad bipartisan support. I want to make sure that this is something that's not unusual for a state to do. Currently, I believe there's about 16 states that allow individuals to be able to vote after they are released from incarceration while they're still serving their supervision, whether that is under DOC or whether that's probation. There are states like Utah, North Dakota, Indiana, Montana. I don't think we would call these as liberal bastions in our country, and that this is something that I think is important for us to begin to move forward. And I would request the chair to possibly allow a couple of people for some public testimony, and I'd be fine with limiting that too, to make some comments regarding this amendment.
Okay. Where are they?
I believe that Mark Hasse, who's been working on this issue for might even be close to a decade now, would be happy to come down and give a few comments.
Mr. Hasse, can you keep it short? And Representative Newberg, do you want to answer your question now, or do you want to wait until after Representative?
I'll wait, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Hasse.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Hasse, and I coordinate and lobby on behalf of the Restore the Vote Minnesota Coalition, which is a coalition of over 70 Minnesota organizations. Maybe the bulk of, I think you all are pretty familiar with this issue, and Representative Dean covered it pretty well, but it's, I think it's very important to that you know who supports this legislation. And that includes the public safety group type groups like the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and the Minnesota Corrections Association, as well as the State Public Defender and Criminal Defense Lawyers, a large group of faith-based organization that represents essentially every major faith group, a large number of direct service organizations, including recently a domestic violence advocacy program joined, the Domestic Abuse Project, and an organization like that, like the county attorneys, as Representative Dean indicated, the reason they support this is because their ultimate goal, as all of ours should be, is to reduce crime, reduce recidivism, reduce the number of future victims. And when people get out of prison or jail and they're in the community paying taxes of some sort, trying to raise their families and support themselves and do the right thing, we want to send them a message that they can be part of the community, and if they want to, this doesn't force them to vote, but if they want to, they can take that positive step to be part of our community through this very essential step of voting. If anybody has any questions about what other states do or how this works in Minnesota, I'd be happy to answer those, but I think I'll leave it with that for now for the sake of brevity. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Dean, for bringing this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Hasse. If we could break in here and let Representative Ward introduce some friends that are here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the back of the room are, I think, 31 students and 9 adults from the Academy of Whole Learning. They're spending the day at the Capitol, and we'd just like to welcome them, and then they're going to go to room 181, right? Mm-hmm. The overflow room where they'll have a chance to sit down and watch us on the screen. And they've toured the Capitol, and they're going to be doing some really interesting things today. So I'd just like to welcome them.
Great, thank you. Representative Neuberger, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a statement here about this amendment that we are, the A1 amendment. I read the amendment, and I am speaking in opposition to this amendment. The first paragraph, an individual convicted of a felony has the civil right to vote restored when the individual completes any incarceration imposed or executed by the court for the offense. Mr. Chair, members, this is a blanket categorization. It just says a felony. Members, I've had this conversation many times over the years with Mr. Hasse, I think with Mr. Dean over the years. I don't recall. I've talked a lot about this. Murder is a felony, and there's two people involved in that kind of a crime. There's the person that killed, and then there's the victim. And if you're asking me to vote to restore the voting rights of someone who took another person's life, I will not do that. because if why in any good conscience should I vote to restore someone's life when the person who's dead will never get that vote restored? If you're dead, you can't vote. So I will not support allowing a murderer, a felony-level murderer, the ability to get his or her vote restored when the person that they killed is cold in the grave and will never get the vote again. Thank you.
Representative Dean, do you have another testifier?
Yeah, I'd like to invite Tommy Franklin down, if he's still in the room. And if I can respond to Representative Neuberger's comment, and though I understand your vehement concern, one of the things that this does is we've already deemed that person safe enough to be out in public to allow them to be out in the community. And anything, I believe that anything we can do to make sure that individual who did something really heinous in their life, that they have an opportunity to repay society through being a good participating citizen. So that would be a conversation that you would have, and we could go back over drinks for a long, long time on it. But thanks for your comments.
Representative Pinto, do you want to ask it now?
Just to add to this, just to point out that somebody who's convicted of homicide, of killing somebody else, once they're done serving their sentence altogether, unless I'm wrong about this, I'd be happy to be corrected, but that person can vote right now. Certainly somebody who does first-degree murder, they may be in for life, but certainly it's possible to take someone else's life to have a sentence that they serve. Person is out, they're not on parole, on probation, not in any way, and that person could then have their civil rights restored, unless I'm misunderstanding. So just to make sure Representative Neuberger understands that. Thank you.
Testifier, your name and title, and begin.
Tommy Franklin, Justice for All organizer at Take Action Minnesota. Wasn't quite prepared, but I'm hearing, like Representative Dean said, 16 states. Minnesota, I feel like Minnesota has a duty to be out in front of issues like this and lead the way when it comes to restoration of not only voting rights, but the humanity of people who have served their time. And, as someone who spent time in prison and got out in 2008, just tell you a quick story. I got out, I was on probation, and in what's arguably the most culturally relative election in this country's history, I was not able to participate in voting in the fall of 2008. And that was a tough thing to grapple with, but when you're getting out of prison and you want to run as far away from those mistakes as possible, being granted opportunities that we feel we have a human right to, especially as taxpayers, especially as we're, making the right changes in our life to move forward, not being granted that right, I feel like is egregious to me. And, I was working at a company on election day in 2008. My coworkers didn't know whether I voted Democrat or Republican. They didn't know my stance politically anyway. But they definitely assumed I was voting for Barack Obama. And I was actually the people that I had to communicate with on a daily basis, up to 100 people, to make sure that we operated in this plant that I was working in. The day after the election, they didn't speak to me for 3 weeks, having made the assumption that I didn't vote the way they voted, but they were very loudly expressing who they voted for in that year's election. And the fact that I couldn't even vote, the fact that they didn't get to know me as an individual, they didn't get to know me as a human being deep enough to know that I had to struggle with the fact that I could not vote, it says a lot about where we are and where we're going. And, the work I do is organize communities who value things like the restoration of voting rights. And I've spoken with people all around the state of Minnesota as recent as only a few weeks ago. Constituents and many of the people on this committee's in their districts who left voicemails for people like Tony Cornish, for Representative Frankie, and they all, their own constituents who voted for them, expressed their support of this amendment. So I just want to let you know that statewide we are behind this amendment and Representative Dean's push to make sure that we have a chance here. Thank you.
Representative Frankie and Hillstrom and Considine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just more of a comment, Representative Dean. I like the concept of the bill and giving people self-worth and allowing them to feel included, to push them to better themselves. I do have some concerns about some wording in the bill, but I do look forward to working with you in the future on addressing the issues that I have and hopefully pushing this further and allowing those people to become included.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just wanted to make it really clear so that in Minnesota right now, people lose the right to vote when they are convicted of a felony. If they get sent to prison and then get out, this bill would allow them to vote upon release of their time incarcerated. It wouldn't allow them to vote currently if they were still on paper, even after they got out. But right now under Minnesota law, the minute you are discharged from probation, the minute you have served your entire sentence, you can get your right to vote back. There are some states in this country that never take away people's right to vote, ever. People vote in prison. It is a public policy decision about when we believe that people have paid their dues and when they should have the right to vote. I'm a prosecutor. I have taken away people's right to vote. In many instances, I have convicted folks on election day, allowing them to vote either before or after that conviction came in prior to sentencing. I believe that someone's right to vote is so important. I have long supported the right for folks to get their voting rights back the minute they have served their time incarcerated. So, members, I support Representative Dean's amendment.
Representative Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I view this bill as, again, public safety. If we great German sociologist Max Weber talks about, if you want people to follow the rules, follow the laws, they have to feel like they have a stake in what's going on. And I think this offers probably the clearest point that, yes, you are back into the community, you do have a stake here, you can vote, and I look at it as something that will make the community safer. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Dean, will you take the vote now?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I would just ask individuals to support this bill or this amendment so that it can possibly be included in their chair's omnibus bill.
Can you ask for a roll call, right?
Please. I'll ask for it now if I haven't.
Okay. The chair would naturally appreciate a no vote. While we're generally supportive, some of us, this bill isn't going anywhere in the Senate, I don't believe, and it would require my bill to make several stops, of which we don't have time in other committees, so the mechanics of it don't work. Oh, go ahead with your vote.
Representative Cornish.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Hillstrom.
Aye.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Yes.
Representative Considine.
Yes.
Representative Dean.
Yes.
Representative Frankie.
No.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Howell.
Pass.
Representative Romer.
No.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Neuberger.
No.
Representative O'Neill.
No.
Representative Pinto.
Yes.
Representative Ward.
Yes.
Representative Zerwas. Representative Howell.
Okay, the vote being 6A and 9 nay, the motion fails. Okay, any other testimony, Representative O'Neill, from your side?
No, Mr. Chair, I have no more invited testifiers.
Okay, thank you. Any public testimony? If not, the chair will, well, you can move your bill, Representative O'Neill, I'm sorry.
Is there any member questions?
Or do you renew your motion for a possible inclusion?
Okay. I renew my motion for House Bill 2176 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill.
Okay. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Okay. The next one would be my bill, House File 2431. This is the court reporter, outdated statutes updated, drug court name changed to treatment court, director field. It's a court's policy bill. We have our court person here to testify. Ms. Marshall? After that short introduction, if you could, the chair will move House File 2431 to be in possible inclusion of the omnibus bill. Go ahead with your name and title.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Janet Marshall, and I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. The bill before you today is primarily a cleanup bill. We did have this before you last year, and you acted favorably on it at that time. What this bill seeks to accomplish is first to clean up statutes dealing with our court reporter profession and their responsibilities. We wanted to update them to reflect current job titles, the court reporter payment methods, and the fact that they are covered under the Judicial Branch Human Resources Rules, so some of these statutes are not necessary. That includes sections 1, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, although I understand sections 7 and 8, there is some concern that we are trying to work out the differences on. The second thing we do is in sections 2 and 3 of the bill, and as Jeff Schorber, the State Court Administrator, explained, we have, the Judicial Council has changed the umbrella term from drug courts to treatment courts to better reflect what is happening in these entities. Sections 4 and 11 clarify the statutes relating to penalty of perjury for documents provided to the court. Right now, under our electronic filing environment, people can file documents with the court, and instead of having to have them notarized, they file them under the penalty of perjury, which is the same process used when we all file our income tax returns. The current statute says it applies to documents filed to the court. There is some concern that some documents are presented to judges but not necessarily filed, things like search warrants, so we want to make it clear that the penalty of perjury statute also applies in these cases. Section 5 of the bill has to do with probate court in Hennepin County. Hennepin County uses referees in their probate matters. The referees hear cases, and then their decisions are reviewed and signed by the probate judge. If a party is unhappy with this, they can ask that the same judge who signed the referee order now hear the case anew. What this proposal will do is it still requires that the judge sign off on the probate referees decision, but that appeals will go from Hennepin County to directly to the Court of Appeals, which happens in all other counties and is happening now in family court in Hennepin County. Last year, they estimated it impacted 5 cases. The year before that, there were 4, and the year before that, there were 2. And last, Section 12. In 2014, the legislature changed the law to say that the timeline for requesting a hearing on a harassment restraining order is 20 days from the date of service of the order. This was to make sure that everybody had time to see the order and to request a hearing. There actually were 2 statutes that need to be changed, and only one of them got changed, so this is a cleanup to change the other necessary statute. And that's what our bill does.
Okay, and thing I was going to announce is there's not yet consensus on Section 7-8 as well as a repeal of a statute, so the intention would be not to include those until we've reached some consensus further down the line. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for making that clarification as well, because I was going to ask that question. But the question is for the court. Why did you decide to change the name from drug court to treatment court and not from drug court to specialty court? By naming them only treatment court, you would not be able to do any other specialty court and fund them in the areas of child protection, which we're hearing a ton of cases on, and termination of parental rights cases and some custody cases. And if we're attempting to do some specialty kinds of courts to try to improve the process, why wouldn't you just change the name to specialty court to allow the court more flexibility in how you reform the system.
Ms. Marshall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I think we're talking about two kinds of courts here. The Drug Court Initiative, which is the advisory committee on all of our treatment courts, spent many hours talking about the need to call it something other than drug courts. Specialty courts was considered and was not the one that they chose to forward to the Judicial Council for review because many people think of specialty courts as family court, as juvenile protection court, and those do not fit under the rubric of the Drug Court Initiative and the special treatment courts that this is aimed at and that our money goes to, that you provide.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. So, Ms. Marshall, is it the legislature that specifically determines that it can only be used in criminal matters or treatment kinds of courts, or is that the court's rules that set that in place that put the limit on where the dollars could be spent?
Ms. Marshall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, in the past when the legislature has provided funds, it has been part of the rider language that it was supposed to be used for things like drug courts. You at the time called them specialty courts, and it was quite clear when the money was appropriated that those were the kinds of things we thought that you wanted us to spend it on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other testimony? Sharon Steinbrecher, are you here?
No.
Mr. Carl.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Steinbrecher is going to stand down today based on your comments and our working with the court. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. All right. If there are no questions, any public testimony, Chair will renew his motion that House File 2431 be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Thank you, Ms. Marshall. House File 2364. Mr. Bernstein, do you want to go first? For the public's information, this is a DWI task force recommendation bill. We're going to hear it today, hold it over for possible inclusion, try to get parts of it we can pass. It's been long in waiting, and Mr. Bernstein is going to present and maybe have a couple other people here, and there'll be number of testifiers after Mr. Bernstein. Go ahead, Mr. Bernstein, with your name and title and begin. I will move House File 2364 to be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Bernstein, and I'm the chair of Minnesota's DWI Task Force. This bill is being brought in direct response to some recent case law decided last year by both the United States Supreme Court, originating out of Minnesota, North Dakota, as well as Minnesota Supreme Court cases. Brief overview, there are three ways to collect impairment evidence in a DWI case. That's through a blood test, a breath test, or a urine test. Previously, Minnesota relied upon the implied consent laws, indicating that law enforcement would read an implied consent advisory, advising suspects that refusal to submit to a crime is a penalty, and then offer them the choice of taking a test or refusing the crime. What the United States and Minnesota Supreme Courts held is that this was constitutional as it related to breath tests, but it was unconstitutional as it related to blood and urine tests without a search warrant. Since that time, law enforcement has changed the way they investigate cases, and they still rely on the implied consent laws for breath tests, but for blood and urine tests, they have followed the United States and Minnesota Supreme Court's directives and obtained search warrants. This has created a problem and inequity in terms of how these suspects are treated. In breath test cases, the results of the test or the refusal is reported to the Department of Public Safety, and on a positive test or refusal, an offender's driver's license is immediately revoked. In a blood and urine test case, that is not happening. But in addition to that, the search warrant allows law enforcement to obtain a blood or urine sample even through forcible means. It is a judicial order authorizing the collection of evidence. And so since officers have obtained search warrants, they have been forcibly obtaining blood draws from individuals. And the purpose of Minnesota's refusal laws was to prevent just that, to protect people's privacy and allow them to refuse a test if they refuse to do so. And so this bill does three things. Number one, it amends Minnesota's implied consent laws to refer to breath tests only, and that is consistent with the United States and Minnesota Supreme Court case law that was decided. But number two, we have the refusal law. If a person refuses to submit to a breath test, they're charged with that crime. This would create a separate provision allowing someone to be charged with refusing to comply with the execution of the search warrant. What this would do is if law enforcement is faced with the option of taking a forcible blood test, they do not do so. Instead, they honor that refusal. There are not five or six officers that are holding someone down, strapping them down, and forcibly extracting their blood. Instead, an offender is simply charged with a crime of refusing to comply with the execution of a warrant. This is important for a couple of reasons. Number one, law enforcement does not desire to forcibly extract blood samples from an individual. It's somewhat barbaric. It takes sometimes five or six law enforcement officials to do it. Some departments don't have that manpower. In addition to that, some hospitals have refused to allow forcible blood draws, and that includes the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. And so in those cases, law enforcement cannot obtain the evidence needed. And in addition, we can't charge the crime of refusal. So again, this would allow for law enforcement to not take the blood draw forcibly and allow us to charge the crime of refusal, which is consistent with breath test cases. And finally, the third provision of our bill is to allow for a license revocation pursuant to a positive test or refusal on blood and urine test cases. And this is, again, to equate the processes with breath tests and blood and urine test cases. It essentially takes us back to where we were, but under the proper legal and constitutional authority. Those are the reasons why we are proposing this bill. I'm happy to report that the DWI Task Force worked in collaboration with the Minnesota State Bar Association Criminal Defense Law Section, or I'm sorry, the Criminal Law Section, consisting of both prosecutors and defense attorneys. And the Criminal Law Section has officially endorsed this proposal. They do support it. This proposal has also been supported and endorsed by the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. And I also have letters of written support from Minnesotans for Safe Driving, Mothers Against Drunk Driving in the state of Minnesota, the South Lake Minnetonka Police Department, and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee members have. Thank you.
Any questions, Ed, or should we move on to our next testifier? Seeing none, Chief Jeff Tate of the City of Shakopee. Welcome, sir, and give you your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jeff Tate. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Shakopee. I'm also a director on the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Board of Directors and a member of the Minnesota DWI Task Force. The Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association is proud to support this proposed legislation. As Mr. Bernstein highlighted, it does update and reflect recent state and U.S. Supreme Court decisions. Public safety has been anxiously awaiting several court decisions to clarify DWI procedures. We now have that clarity, which necessitates this bill. The bill restores the consequences the legislature created and supported over the past decades. For brevity's sake, I won't get into each point as Mr. Bernstein did, but I do, again, want to throw our support behind this. I think the fact that so many different disciplines in public safety support this bill speaks volumes and is a testament to, A, the need for such a bill and the quality of the bill itself. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Colonel Matt Langer, Chief of the State Patrol, would you like to come to the table and give us your name and title and begin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Langer for the record, and I serve as the Chief of the Minnesota State Patrol. Also, for the sake of brevity, I won't repeat what has already been said by Mr. Bernstein and Chief Tate, but I'm here on behalf of the Department of Public Safety and the Minnesota State Patrol to offer our support for this bill. We think it restores equity. We think it restores a consistent process, and it is a good thing for traffic safety and public safety in our state.
Thank you very much, Chief. Appreciate it. Member questions? Did we have any public testimony? Okay. Seeing none, Chair will move House File 2364 to be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much, Mr. Bernstein.
Thank you.
Okay. Now we have the Representative Tim Miller's prison bill, House File 1510. For the crowd's information, you know from being here before that I like to give everybody a chance to testify on both sides. And actually, I gave, I think, opposition more last time. And so, to be fair, we're going to run over just for you folks so you'll all be able to testify. We're going to go over the limit. I would just ask that in change for that courtesy that you give us the same and refrain from clapping, yelling, shouting. And let's have an orderly meeting, and we'll hear everybody on both sides. And the bill is just going to be held over for possible inclusion at this point anyway. So the chair would move House File 1510 to be held over for possible inclusion. Ms. Representative Miller, go ahead with your
amendment.
Okay, the A2 and the B1 instead of
the A2.
Okay. Representative Miller, the chair will move House the H1510A2 amendment to your bill. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for hearing my bill today. This bill is simple and straightforward. It requires the Department of Corrections Commissioner to enter into negotiations to utilize the Prairie Correctional Facility in Appleton, Minnesota, either through lease, to own, or purchase of the facility. This bill is to address a simple fact. By the department's own recognition, there are not enough beds for current state offenders. Those numbers are going to increase, and there is a fully functional, adequate facility in Appleton, Minnesota to address those needs. None of these facts are disputed. Last year, the Department of Corrections referred to prison overcrowding in Minnesota as a crisis. By the department's own projections, which were presented to this committee earlier this session, our offender population will grow and exceed current capacity by more than 900 inmates by 2024. Members, that means that nearly 10% of the offenders in the state's care will not be able to be housed in state correctional facilities. As I said, there's not enough beds, nor are there in the future, and there's an existing asset in Minnesota that can address this problem. That's not disputed. What is disputed are many other objections presented over the last couple of years. I believe we have addressed all of the stated concerns, only to still have disagreement with the department, and I don't understand why. I was told we shouldn't have a private prison housing Minnesota offenders, so we made it clear that the state should lease the entire facility or buy it and have department officers running it. I was told non-union members shouldn't work there. If the DOC runs it, there won't be. In fact, there will be 200 to 300 union jobs created. I was told there was not a sufficient labor pool in the region, and so we looked with deed zone numbers. We proved that incorrect. I was told Appleton residents didn't support this, and we filled the town hall with over 500 residents showing up in support. We have an online petition that has well over 1,000 signatures. There are over 50 cities, counties, and regional organizations supporting the Appleton option. I've been told Appleton is too far away from the rest of the facilities and too far away from the urban core. If you look at my graphic that was handed out, you will see that Appleton is closer to the main hub for processing incoming offenders in St. Cloud than Faribault, and it's only slightly further than Stillwater. If you look at other states nearby, also on my graphic, you'll see a much more diversified prison system away from metropolitan centers. Also at this time, we have state offenders housed in county jails throughout the state, overburdening that system as well. I've been told Appleton facilities are not to standard. They are run down and need improvements. And yet today as we sit here, the facility is fully licensed to operate in the state. It is rated at this time to a level 4 security. It has a full-time staff at this time ensuring all functions of the facility are fully operational. Anyone who has toured the facility knows it to be among the best in the state. Furthermore, when the state enters into negotiations to lease the owner to purchase, any required improvements will be part of that conversation. I had correctional officers visit my office a few weeks ago, and they showed concern as to the medical capabilities of the region should an officer need attention. If you will again look at my graphic, we have displayed the EMS capabilities. There's a hospital and ambulance service in Appleton. If an injury is serious enough, airlift services from Wilmer and Redwood Falls can be there within 18 minutes. If weather or other reasons prohibit a helicopter from these locations, they can come from St. Cloud or Fargo. Plus, Mr. Chair, there is more than just a housing crisis the state is facing. At this time, there are approximately 500 state offenders housed in county jails. They are not receiving the drug treatment, mental health care, or education intended to reduce recidivism and to make them productive members of our society when they have served their time. Members of the committee, despite a lot of objections, there is still one simple truth. The state does not have enough beds for current or future needs, and there is an asset already available to address this need in Appleton, Minnesota. I offer the amendment as a way to allow the DOC to address their crisis in a reasonable time. We need a solution to prison overcrowding in Minnesota now, and I believe that utilizing the Appleton Prison Policy Facility is a no-brainer. It presents the most cost-effective, flexible option to meet our current and future needs, and I ask for your support. Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I have a couple testifiers.
Okay, sir, you're on name and title and begin.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Gary Hendricks. I'm a Swift County Commissioner since 1997. I'm also the current president of the Association of Minnesota Counties. I concur a lot with what our representative just said, and a lot of my testimony was to go into that, so and to spare you the time. Basically, I want to assure people we are not here to say we want more people locked up. That is not our request at all. What I'm asking you to do is to consider addressing a serious problem, and that is in a straightforward and a financial responsible way. Last year, when you passed legislation about sentencing reform, we hope that these reforms will have an impact on the state of Minnesota inmate population, but they were not really meant to decrease the total population. They were to slow the growth. And we know that the growth will continue. So we're looking for this option as an option for the state to enter into an agreement. Again, we're not looking for it to be run by another entity other than the state of Minnesota. And that is our request today. On behalf of thousands of Minnesotans who live in western Minnesota, I think this is the best opportunity for our community. It employed people over 20 counties. It took a wide swath of our area and added economic development to it. But again, we're there to program the individuals that are currently incarcerated. And overall, we think this is the best solution for a serious and persistent problem. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Your name and title and begin.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for considering this proposal. And thanks for Representative Tim Miller for championing it. My name is Chad Silpe. I am the mayor of the city of Appleton. I am in front of this committee today as the mayor of a town that has seen the community asset be the source of jobs, controversy, and opportunity. Regardless of your feelings about the owner of the prison in the Appleton facility, it is my hope that you will listen to our community's story and our request. We are asking that the state of Minnesota do an honest, transparent, and thorough analysis of what it might mean for the state of Minnesota to own or lease the Appleton facility as opposed to continue forward with its past proposal to build new prison beds. Beyond the physical structure of the prison that our community has to offer, Appleton, Swift County, and the surrounding region offers the infrastructure necessary to provide quality rehabilitation and support services to inmates that are there prepared to reenter their communities. We also provide a wonderful quality of life for working families. The commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Corrections said that the housing state inmates in county jails is not an ideal solution, and of course we agree. The prison facility is in Appleton is well-equipped and has ample space to provide all the same programming that is provided in other state correctional facilities. In addition, I urge the members of this committee to consider the state's other aging correctional facilities. The St. Cloud Stillwater prisons are both well over 100 years old, making them extremely costly to maintain and keep up to date. As the state of Minnesota considers not only to solve prison overcrowding in the short term, but also how to continue to provide high-quality corrections in the long term. The Appleton Prison Facility presents a much newer, modern, and viable alternative to increasingly old and costly prohibitive prison facilities. Any way you look at it, the prison facility in Appleton must be a major part of the discussion about the future of corrections in Minnesota. We are here today to urge you to do what is best for the inmates, for the public safety, and for our communities in western Minnesota, and for the state as a whole. Please support this proposal and move forward with the Appleton option. Thank you very much for your time today.
Representative Hilsman, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to the testifier, Mr. Representative Miller, or you certainly could answer it. It's my understanding that in the last round of discussions or negotiations, CCA was, House Civic Corps, was proposing that the state pay approximately $100 million for the facility if they were to buy it. Yet the value, the local value that's been placed on the facility is about $14 million. This facility was once owned by the local jurisdictions. I think it was the county or a collaborative. If the collaborative or the local units of government think that this is such a great deal for the state, why don't they consider purchasing the facility and attempt to lease the beds to the state, as many of the folks' concerns is with a private entity? This was once owned by a local unit of government. Why is it that the local unit of government themselves aren't looking to purchase this facility and are looking to the state to do it?
Whoever would like to answer it.
Mr. Chair, I can do that.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, and if I miss any part, there's a couple different questions in there, so please repeat that. So first of all, the history on the numbers that were put, last year when we were negotiating, it was very difficult. The whole emphasis last year was to negotiate with the governor's office, Department of Administration, Department of Corrections. And with that, there were no numbers out there. There were simply hypotheticals. There was increased pressure from the governor's office to say, well, what do you think that you want? Should we move forward? And so it's my understanding that CCA, which is now called Core Civic, so if you hear it called that, understand. What Core Civic suggested was an initial offering, and it was either $99 million over 3 years at no interest. The discussion to lease on real basic figures was based on just prison population numbers and stuff was between 6 to 8 million, but that was also totally established off of nothing firm of what the state would even want to do with the facility. That was only at the request of the governor's office to throw down a number, but it was strongly emphasized. I was at not that meeting, but I was at subsequent meetings to where they emphasized to me, Representative Miller, this is just a number that we're throwing. We anticipate that we're going to have vigorous and good conversations with the department as to what the real value is, as to what the lease would be, because you can't set a lease if you don't know what you're going to do. So that was considered. Any of the improvements that need to be made, we get folded into that. I sensed a good faith effort by Core Civic to move forward in that way. Now, you're referring to about the $14 million was the assessed value. Mm-hmm. That was negotiated, and that's where these two people may be able to get the history on that. But my understanding is that was a negotiated property tax value on a prison sitting empty. As you might imagine, an empty asset has totally different dynamics, especially of that size. And so I can't attest to why they negotiated that amount. I'm not saying the place is worth $14 million. I'm not saying it's worth $99 million. I'm not saying it's worth $500. I'm not saying it's worth $5 million. The point is what my bill is intended to do is to bring the state of Minnesota to the table, understanding that they have a need for more beds, and there's an asset in greater Minnesota that's ready to go to be able to do it. What the state purchases for it is up to the people that negotiate that.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'd like to ask the local units of government. You previously owned the facility, and then you sold it to the private entity. Has there been any discussion about the local community purchasing it and leasing beds back to the state, as many other share entities currently do?
As far as with the city of Appleton, there hasn't been any discussion with us to buy the facility. I think the facility as a whole right now would probably be more than what the Appleton community could handle as far as a financial obligation. As far as if we could look at buying it and then having a solid lease set up so that we would be able to handle the bond payments, that might be open for discussion. But as of to now, that has never come up to us that if we were to look at buying it, that the state would look at leasing it from the local community and then make the lease payments, which we can turn around and then service the debt.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only reason why I ask is because many times we get testimony that this is a public need, that this is in the public good to own and operate this facility. But local units of government have the opportunity to do many things to deal with local need, and I haven't once heard anyone talk about taking the prison back via eminent domain. And if it was a real public need, right, you could make the argument that the state or the local unit of government should be in possession of this asset. It is in the public's best interest. I mean, then we wouldn't be talking about whether or not CoreCivic or CCA is a good business to get into to do a deal with. And I'll have more conversations about that, Mr. Chair, when we get to my amendment.
Okay, short answer, Representative.
Very short answer, Mr. Chair, Representative Helfrin. Talking about eminent domain to just take someone's property is a very serious discussion, and I don't even recommend it. But so I would caution against that.
Okay.
Who do we have? Any more supporters for you guys or testimony, or do we go to the opposition now? Who out there would like to testify? Oh, excuse me. Commissioner Roy, you wanted to say a few things? We have good opportunity. And then if you folks want to figure out a spokesman or something, you got somebody who'd like to. Oh, we have a list here. Max Hall, if you're here, why don't you get on the queue ready to go after the commissioner. Commissioner, welcome. With your name and title, and begin.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Tom Roy, Commissioner of Corrections. I think I have represented the position of the department and the governor last year, and it has been well documented. I would just like to speak to the amendment. And as a practitioner, the amendment, I think, is more palatable in that it says at such time that the commissioner determines that the department has insufficient number of prison beds. The growth of prison capacity is a concern to us. Of course it is. But this proposal suggests that there's only one solution to a prison growth, and that only solution is adding another facility. And if you recall from previous testimony, we have offered other strategies to deal with prison population, and some of those are already bearing fruit. The drug legislation, if you recall in my previous testimony, has already reduced some numbers, and we will demonstrate those more significantly in another 6 months. But we are already seeing with some policy adjustments regarding parole violators, we are seeing that our housing out of facility, which is what we call our jail population, we are currently at about 300, down from the 500, which was earlier quoted. So we're seeing a leveling and even a downward trend in that jail usage. The state also has tremendous capacity right now in county jail beds. There's about 10,000 total jail beds in the state. The average daily population for those jail beds is about 7,400. And the functional capacity that's available in county jails is 1,600 beds. That's not to say that we would continue or like to use county jails as a solution, but it is certainly an interim option for us. We also have had a pretty significant bonding proposal that does expand capacity in existing facility footprints. A perfect example is our Lino Lakes facility, which has an empty building. with a bonding proposal of about $6 million. We can add about 100 beds to that facility. We have potential to expand our challenge incarceration program, both in Togo and in Willow River. And as we have heard earlier today from the proposal of Representative O'Neill, we are working with community partners to establish community alternatives for violators. About half of our inmates come back to our facilities for under 6 months. So we have a very short duration, very short turnaround for a large number of our folks. And the strategy that was earlier talked about, we think, is very positive and will impact future prison growth. I mentioned the drug reform as a part of last year's activities. That, we hope, will affect prison beds. I'm not sure what the appetite is at, for a continued adjustment of drug sentencing or any other kinds of sentencing, but certainly that is an option as well. So I just wanted to discourage the notion that the only solution to prison capacity is adding another facility. We have offered strategies that are far more cost effective, and the last point I will make is probably the most important point that I will make all morning. Purchasing or leasing is one factor, and that is probably the lesser factor of operating a prison. Once a prison is opened, it of this size or even lesser capacity, we're looking at a $30 to $40 million annual expenditure to operate a prison. That is no insignificant amount. So between the purchase at $50 million perhaps, or a lease, and adding a $30 or $40 million operating budget, pretty soon we have achieved the whole target of this committee. And I think the long-term impact of a budget strategy like that is not necessarily a thoughtful way to approach prison capacity. And I know there are other testifiers. I appreciate the time. I appreciate the diligence that this committee has looked at this issue. I appreciate the diligence that the local community has looked at that. But I'm just offering other solutions, which is my responsibility.
Commissioner, I guess I disagree that I don't know of anybody here that's thought that this was the only solution. In fact, we've been in favor of a lot of solutions that would reduce prison population, you know, with all our programs. And I don't think it's going to be our budget target if we decide to buy the joint. And it's going to come from other places, so it wouldn't be just a committee jurisdiction that we'd have to worry about in our budget. But anybody have a question to the commissioner, or is it just in general?
Just a question for the commissioner. I guess he answered most of what I was going to ask, but I guess you're talking about needing beds, right? And how many beds are available in Appleton, and how many beds are you needing?
Commissioner?
Representative, could you restate that question for me?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Russell.
You said that you were in need of beds because of the number that are housed outside of prison in the county jails and such. Okay. How many beds are there available in Appleton? Someplace that's ready to go?
Appleton, Mr. Chair, Representative, has a capacity of 1,600 beds.
And how many did you say you needed?
We're currently housing out of facility 300.
Okay. Now, that, I guess, would that accommodate what you needed versus new construction at another location?
Mr. Chair, Representative, those beds are certainly available.
Okay. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to give the Commissioner a chance to respond to the point that the Chair made about, because certainly the committee is looking at, has been looking at many other possibilities, but as I read this language, Commissioner, and I guess you'd be the person that's to be directed to, it seems to be saying that once you determine that there's but the number of beds and the population don't match, then you're done. You have to enter into a contract to purchase or operate the facility. It's not that you would have to make a determination that we need a new facility or that we need more beds to be available or any of those things, any of those other options, regardless of whether they may be pursued other places. This language requires you to do this particular option. That's how I read this, but I just want to give you a chance to comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is my interpretation, that once that threshold is achieved, or that I designate or determine that that threshold has been achieved, then my only option is to do this.
Mr. Chair, when we were talking only option, I was just saying that there are other options we're trying to use to reduce prison populations. This is the option we're talking about in this bill, but I mean through the different treatment course that we have and the drug sentencing guidelines, things like that. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to clarify with my very respected, we get along great, Representative Pinto, but we address that because that's a fair question to ask, and it says, at such time, the commissioner determines the department has an insufficient number of prison beds to house the current or projected population and needs to expand an existing facility or build a new facility. So there's the presumption there, and that's why we offered this, because I understand that with my bill we're kind of heavy handed. The next 12 months you're going to take a prison whether you like it or not. And while I disagree with the commissioner on the numbers, I can't prove that I'm wrong, so I appreciate and will respect those numbers, but what we're seeing is anecdotally out in the county jails and stuff, that these numbers are going to increase and it's creating an increasing burden. There is going to come a time, I believe, that the department is going to have to say, okay, we're going to need more beds. Matter of fact, last year they had a bonding proposal for 500 beds. So my amendment is intended to address exactly that. We don't want to force a hand prematurely, but at such time the commissioner says, okay, we need more beds, then we're going to go address those at Appleton. And I would argue that that's being fiscally responsible for the state of Minnesota. I think I've shown with my graphic that there's nothing peculiar about Appleton and distance-wise that would create such a great increase than if they had to create other beds also. And I think that the fiscal note also reflects some of that.
Commissioner, have you solved the problem of prisoners not wanting to be in county jails? When I was a jailer, the last thing a state prisoner wanted to do was come to the county with the lack of a library, lack of an exercise yard, lack of options. What's that like now, all these prisoners out there? Is the amount of service greatly increased out there, or how's that going?
Mr. Chair, county jails certainly don't offer a lot of the programming that we offer in the state prisons. My comment on the short duration of many of our inmates speaks to that even when those short-timers come back to our prison facilities, they aren't offered a full menu of treatment options as well. Some people refer to it as three hots and a cot, and I don't want to make light of that, but many of the offenders that come back on violations into our facilities right now aren't offered a whole lot of programming, unfortunately.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner, for your testimony. I appreciate it. Max? Oh, we got another list over here. Representative Johnson and then Considine.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner. I've heard anywhere number of people we have in the county jail systems anywhere from 300 to 700, and it fluctuates. My understanding, it does fluctuate daily. It could be down at 300 level for a couple months, and then it could jump up again. Everything's in flux. The issue I have, where I'm concerned about, is the fact that those inmates in the county facilities are not getting the treatment programs that we have available in the state system. And that's a big disservice to them. And I think because they're not those treatment and those programs that we have can cause a huge increase in the recidivism rate. I don't think that's good for the public. That's not good for the inmates. It's not good for our staff. It's not good for the county staff. It's a burden. It is a huge burden on the counties. When you look at the last prison that was built was Rush City. That was back in 1980s, late 1980s, early 1900s, or 1990s. We're looking at 30 years since we had a substantial increase in the number of beds in the county in the state system. Do I want to increase the bed capacity? I wish we could decrease it. That was because people wouldn't be breaking the laws and causing issues, committing felonies that have to go into that system. In fact, right now, Minnesota is one of the lowest incarceration rates in the country. We have some of the shortest sentences in the country. There's many times you have to commit a felony four or five times before you finally get to the state system. Most of it is spent in the county system, and most of it's spent on paper. And we innovated that system many years ago, and we have a lot of states now starting to implement the system that we use. But our population is growing, and unfortunately, the percentage of those that commit crime is staying somewhat flat. That means as our population grows, our number we have incarcerated is going to grow. And in 30 years, we went from having just enough beds to cover everything to being three to, your numbers, by 2024, we're going to be 900 beds short. I see this as an option to look at. Not only would it alleviate the issues of having these, as you put, three hots in a cot, but having a facility where these individuals could have the treatment programs and the services that could make them useful in the communities. But it also do another thing. The rest of our system that is bulging at the wall and the doors are ready to explode because they're so full is causing safety concerns at those facilities, where the numbers could be brought down at those facilities to make them safer and better for the not only the staff, but for the individuals that are incarcerated there. So, Representative Miller, I want to thank you for bringing this forward, and I do like this amendment because it gives them time to look at it, gives us time to look at the numbers, what's going to be best not only for the community of Appleton, but for the state of Minnesota.
Okay, we're going to have Representative Considine question, and then we've got to get through the public testimony. So, Representative Considine.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Roy, has anybody from your organization inspected the prison, been inside of it, looked around? The reason I'm asking is because I recall that when they first opened up, it was discovered that CCA, or of course, whatever their name is now, hadn't bothered to put in sprinkler system, and that it then had to be put in. The other thing was that a number of the, initially the quality of the construction was suspect. At one point there was a riot out at Appleton, and that was directly related to there was nothing to do. Is there programming space even in the prison? CCA was not known for actually including that in their prisons. And like I said, one time there was the riot. I actually got to see video of that at one point in a training facility. So my question is anybody from your organization taking a look at this? Is there programming space? Is there an adequate kitchen? Is there problems with the facility as far as the construction?
If you give as short an answer as possible, then we're going to go into Representative Hilstrom's amendment and then public testimony. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, I would like to offer you our inspection report that will give you details. We have to license that facility, and if it was operated by another entity, we have to see what the staffing patterns are, what the programming structure is to determine if it does meet ACA standards, American Corrections Association standards. So there's the physical plant, and then there's the operational plan that has to be approved, and I will gladly share that with you. It's not falling down, and I, in my conversations with the county folks, they have suggested that there is regular maintenance.
Okay. Representative Filstrom, would you like to offer your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to offer, I believe it's the DE1 amendment.
Representative Hilstrom offers the DE1 amendment. You want to explain your amendment, Representative Hilstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I have introduced a bill which bans the use of private prisons here in Minnesota, and that is this language. This bill has existed for a number of years. Members, one of the most common critiques of private prisons is that the industry's goal is to maximize profits, and that's at odds with the traditional goals of our criminal justice systems. And as such, offender rehabilitation, reducing recidivism rates, and keeping the public safe become at odds when you're dealing with a private entity. Now, Representative Miller did do an amendment to change the proposal slightly. But, members, one of the biggest challenges with this proposal is, one, who we would be buying the prison from in the event the state bought it. But in the event the state leased the prison, the state would either be in a position to lease the entire thing, which the state doesn't need, to the tune of more than $26 million or more per year, or they would be in a situation where they would lease a portion of the space and allow CCA or CoreCivic to continue to use the facility for other inmates. So that's one of the reasons why CCA's reputation and historical perspective is really valid and important related to this facility. At one time, the state of Minnesota did, in fact, lease beds from CCA, and there were audits and there were problems. It was a bipartisan effort to stop leasing space from CCA, and it was actually Governor Pawlenty who stopped using the facility. CCA or CoreCivic had allegations and lawsuits and court awards of damages because of civil rights violations, of abuses, and of medical neglect. And I could go through those cases one at a time, but in light of the public testimony that we still want to take, I'm not going to do that. There were incidents of violence, which was higher in private prisons than in the publicly managed facilities. And members, our own study right here in Minnesota showed that any inmate that we sent to the Prairie Correctional Facility was more likely to recidivate. So in 2013, the Minnesota Department of Corrections performed a study of 3,532 Minnesota prisoners released between 2007 and 2009. And we found that those persons that were incarcerated at the Prairie Correctional Facility were 13% more likely to be rearrested and 22% more likely to be then convicted. So I've been working on this proposal to not do business with CCA for a long time, the better part of a decade. They are not good citizens. They have been found to have lied about their staffing. They have been found liable for damages due to that. And members, that was one of the reasons why I asked why the local community themselves weren't considering whether or not they wanted to buy this prison. The CCA has consistently asked for like $100 million when they actually sued to bring down the value of their property to $14 million, even when it was still housing inmates. So, with that, I ask that members vote in favor of this amendment. We do not belong leasing this facility. We do not belong buying this facility. We don't currently have a need for it, and we do not want to be in the business with a company like CCA. I'd ask for roll call, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill, roll call noted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Representative Hillstrom, I just have a question, a clarification. Since I just brought the bill that would encourage restructure and to places that are nonprofits like RS Eden, Minnesota Teen Challenge, and so on, and your definition of inmate, would that conflict with what I just tried to do with restructure, or also when Teen Challenge also receives folks from the courts when they have been sentenced essentially to treatment? And I just want to make sure that this amendment would not do anything to any of the nonprofits that do such good work for, especially in chemical dependency treatment and some in mental health treatment. It would be the definition of what an inmate is, and is that, are they under the jurisdiction of the DOC? Because then they would fall under that, and all of those great nonprofits would be prohibited from actually receiving any of the inmates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill. This would not impact any of those treatment facilities. This is about inmates that are being housed in these correctional facilities. There is an additional facility that is locally operated here in Minnesota that is operated by a nonprofit in Ramsey. It would impact that. I do not believe that this state should be outsourcing our prison population and the corrections that we do, and that's what this goes to. So it doesn't affect those.
Okay, if there's no other questions, any follow-up?
Mr. Chair, I just want to get that confirmed from nonpartisan staff. I'm just really concerned that something like this would head us in a direction that we don't want to go that's outside of the intended consequences.
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, inmate is defined as someone who's committed to the Commissioner of Corrections, and so if they're not sent to the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections, then they wouldn't fall under this restriction. But if they're kept local, they would not be committed to the Commissioner of Corrections.
Representative Johnson, quickly.
Mr. Chair, again, I had the same concerns as Representative O'Neill, but maybe Mr. Debo can clarify. If somebody is on probation, felony probation, are they under the Department of Corrections? If so, if they have a condition that requires them to be involved in a treatment program or something like that, would that affect that?
Mr. Diebel, do you understand the question?
Mr. Chair, could he, Mr. Johnson, or Representative Johnson, repeat the question?
Go ahead and repeat the question.
If somebody's on probation, are they under the Department of Corrections, if it's a felony probation?
What about it?
Would that be, would this cover them as not being able to be involved in like a nonprofit organization for treatment or something like that if they're court ordered there under felony probation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, as long as the court does not commit the offender to the commissioner, then they would not be under the commissioner's control, and so they'd be handled locally by the court and local probation.
Okay. Representative Hilstrom has offered the DE1 amendment, asked for a roll call. Go ahead, take the vote.
Representative Cornish?
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Hilstrom?
Aye.
Representative Becker-Finn?
Yes.
Representative Considine?
Yes.
Representative Dean?
Aye.
Representative Frankie?
No.
Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Howe?
Nay.
Representative Romer?
No.
Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Neuberger?
No.
Representative O'Neill?
No.
Representative Pinto?
Yes.
Representative Ward?
Yes.
Representative Zerwas?
No.
Okay, the vote 10 nay and 6 a, the motion fails. Okay, we got Max Hall asked me on the list here. One question that I had is when the testifiers come up is where the responsibility will lie if the federal government does approve federal prisons and we have a federal prison once the Department of Correction hasn't been much help and we haven't made a lease to run by the DOC or any arrangements to be made by run to state workers, who's going to have responsibility for that fall on? Whose fault is that? In other words, you've heard a lot of talk nationally about making federal prisons or private prisons nationally. And that's one thing I worry about is all this lack of cooperation or trying to find some system where we can make it work as a state prison with state workers and union workers. And we ignore that and don't do it, and then it comes in after the fact and has made a private prison. So that's one of the drives I'm kind of trying to figure out where the common sense is in that. But Max, which one are you? Go ahead, sir. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Max Hall. I'm the legislative representative with AFSCME Council 5. The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees represents about 43,000 Minnesotans, and we are strongly opposed to House File 1510, Representative Miller's bill to reopen the private prison facility located in Appleton, Minnesota. We are strongly supportive of House File 1692, which is Representative Hillstrom's bill to ban private prisons, and we were disappointed to see that Representative Hillstrom's DE1 amendment failed in this committee. AFSCME Council 5 and our members have taken a position that we are strongly supportive of banning private prisons throughout the state of Minnesota. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I will conclude, and I will turn it over to two of our correctional officer members for additional testimony, starting with Sergeant Rick Nyson.
Thank you, Mr. Hall, for your brevity. Go ahead, sir, your name and title.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Rick Nyson. I'm a corrections officer at the Minnesota Correctional Facility in St. Cloud. I'm also the president of our AFSCME Local 599 and a proud Council 5 executive member of AFSCME. I worked in the prisons for 25 years. The private prison industry is again trying to get a foothold in Minnesota. Please stop them. We don't want to work for a corporation that drives down our wages, benefits, and retirement security. But this is much more than protecting a good job, a good union job that provides for our families. It's immoral to profit from locking people up. It has nothing to do with justice, and it's all about corporations making billions from human misery. We exposed CCA so well that they changed their name to CoreCivic. But rebranding cannot erase their abuses. Let's be clear. Criminal justice is the core responsibility of government. Public workers should be protecting public safety, period. Here's our problem. Our state-run prisons are full, and legislators want to remedy the overcrowding. Some think the solution is to reopen a private prison in Appleton. They want the state to lease it, and they want corrections to run it and staff it. This is wrong on many, many levels. AFSCME opposes the lease. Our corrections officers don't want to work in a CoreCivic prison. The Department of Corrections doesn't want or need the Appleton prison, and Governor Dayton has pledged to veto a bill to lease it. You may ask yourself, why is AFSCME worried about the lease? Corrections officers will staff the prison and run it. Beware of the bait and switch. Once the lease runs out, CoreCivic will raise the price significantly or will be there to step in and run the prison. They'll invite us to apply for a job as a low-wage guard in an understaffed prison. That's how they do business, and the price will be sky-high. And Minnesotans will pay for not pay for it in only dollars and cents. Doing business with CoreCivic is like doing business with the devil. The company cuts corners to make a buck, and they profit off of human misery. Their trail of abuses are well-documented. Spoiled, wormy food. Inmates triple bunked and left without medical care. Toilets with no running water. Inmates forced to defecate in plastic bags. Riots, excessive force, and sexual assault. These dangerous conditions put inmates, staff, and public at risk. I was taught three things as a young officer. I am responsible for the public safety, the safety of my coworkers, and the safety of our inmates. That's difficult to accomplish most days. Imagine trying to do it with a CEO or a board of directors dictating your actions for profit. You may wonder why I condemn prisons. My faith guides my work as a correctional officer. It is not my job to judge or punish anyone in my charge. I believe that will be taken care of way above my pay grade. Treating each other with respect and dignity is not something we should do. It's something we must do. My coworkers take that approach every time they put this uniform on. Reopening Appleton benefits one group and one group only. That's CoreCivic. AFSCME supports sentencing reform as a better way to address our overcrowding prisons. The sentencing reform bill offered by Senator Lantz passed with bipartisan support last session. It should remedy the problem of overcrowding, so there's no need for these private prison beds. The best way to invest in public safety is to bond for a new intake in St. Cloud. new medical beds in Lionel Lakes, and a boot camp in Togo. You should also support the DOC's request for 86 additional correctional officers. Don't let Civic Corps laugh all the way to the banks with our tax dollars. Thank you for listening, and again, we oppose House File 510. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, sir. Next up, your name and title, and begin.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Brian Lowers. I'm a corrections sergeant at the state prison in Faribault. Approximately 20 years ago, I worked for CCA at the Appleton facility. I worked there for 9 months. I've seen some of the bait and switch procedures they use. I got hired as corrections officer out there with under the presumption that after 3 months I'd be promoted to a caseworker, which was consistent with my education background as I got a degree in psychology and corrections and was looking to go into the probation field. I went out to that facility, and after approximately 3 months, I was passed over for a promotion or moved to the position that I was looking to go out there and actually work in due to a lack of ability of the CCA to get staffing for security. That went on, and it happened a second and a third time. At that point, I saw that, you know, this is not nothing more than a bait and switch, and I am not doing anything here for my career, and I left the area. I'm not the only one out there at the time. Many people left the area because of situations like that. There's been some talk about the infrastructure of the facility out there. I worked out there, and I know that there was areas that weren't maintained, whether it be due to lighting, plumbing, or whatnot. And there really isn't a whole lot of tradesmen in that area to respond to situations like that to repair things. CCA was trying to make the state believe that they met all these inspections, but there was significant problems there. In that area, there's a lower population than many of the areas where our other facilities are. There's a lower population to draw employees from. In Appleton, per se, there's a very limited amount of professional people in the psychology, mental health field, health services field, RNs, doctors, whatnot. The smaller Appleton Hospital is not able to deal with a major emergency with major medical problems, be it with a staff person or inmates. There's just not the personnel there. Someone mentioned that there was that they could draw staff from 20 different counties. Well, 20 different counties is a long ways away for some people to relocate to or to respond. When I lived out in Appleton, I believe there was one full-time police officer, perhaps another part-time officer. Swift County Sheriff's Department, not a large county and not a large budget, they probably didn't have a very big, they didn't have a lot of deputies. So in the event of, you know, weather emergencies, power outages, or situations where there would be an evacuation of the prison, there was no plan by CCA or anyone out there. They just hoped it wouldn't happen. But I don't think that the Minnesota wants to...
You've got to finish up here. We're pushing the limit on the occupation room, but I want,
okay.
Like I say, I wanted to get everybody. We got three more people on the list behind you in opposition. So.
Okay. For instance, to speak of the lack of staffing, after I told CCA that I was going to be leaving, resigning there, they placed me in a what would be considered like a K building in the Department of Corrections where there's 3 to 4 wings. I was put in there. There was no staff out checking on the offenders. I was the only one there, and due to the security, I could not go out and check on offenders because I had the key to the security bubble and could not give up that security.
All right. Will you wrap up?
Sure. Someone spoke to programming and rehabilitation services available in the core facility at Appleton. The library is probably approximately the size of this room, and I don't believe you could fit 900 offenders in there. Health services and other areas are also small. The core building is
Wrap up, please.
Yes. One second.
Well, I keep saying wrap up, you keep going. I got to get three other people up here. Our members are going to start filtering out. There'll be nobody to hear you pretty soon. But so
The core of the facility is not built to promote security for offenders nor the safety of the staff.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Now, who have we got on the list here? We've got Megan Hill. She's here. Members have to be the other community, but I want a maximum number here to hear you. So if you could make it short, we have the Rachel English and Jim Rubenstein or something like that. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Megan Hill. I'm on the board of directors of Minnesota Public Interest Research Group. Additionally, I am the founder and president of Jewish Community Action at the University of Minnesota. I'm a resident of Minneapolis and a student at the University of Minnesota. Today I'd like to speak as the moral and logical voice in opposition to mass incarceration, specifically in regards to the proposed reopening of the Prairie Correctional Facility in Appleton. To start, I'd like to reiterate the human rights violations committed by CoreCivic, from forced labor, food shortages, poor sanitation, and most notably, medical negligence. At one of their facilities, they even prescribed drinking water for broken bones and post-surgery care. This is not a corporation I'd like to see Minnesota doing business with. Even without private ownership and operation, reopening this facility is not the answer. Because of Appleton's remote location, it would force a barrier for inmates to have connections with their families, and this would contribute to us raising the recidivism rates due to the lack of connection. I'd like to make it clear we are not against the city of Appleton. We, too, would like to see their economy prosper. However, doing this at the expense of human beings is immoral. There are alternatives. As I mentioned earlier, I'm a student, and working with MPRG, I've met students from our Morris chapter. These students are bright individuals, and they have outstanding goals and aspirations. If we really want to see rural Minnesota grow, we need to make it attractive for young people to want to live there. A prison is not going to achieve that. Appleton and the people of rural Minnesota have the potential and the need to be the leaders of something better, from the deficit in rural health care to the capacity for renewable energy and water quality. These are the industries that will make jobs and attract young people to the prairie. In closing, my colleagues and I refuse to stand idly by as individuals in power make the regretful decision to expand our prison system and build an economy off the backs of inmates while failing to address the root cause of the issue and explore alternatives. It's time we stop pinning the interests of economically distressed communities against each other. It's time we do better for our communities of color that for so long have been devastated by mass incarceration and countless other forms of institutional racism. And it's time we do better for rural Minnesota who are hurting and fighting to regain their sense of home. I sincerely hope you will make the right decision in saying no to this unethical implementation of mass incarceration. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. We have Rachel English. Followed by Jim, and this is the last one I have on my list.
My name is Rachel English, and I'm with Jewish Community Action. We are here to testify in opposition to House File 1510 and in support of the amendment offered by Representative Hillstrom. We are a Jewish faith-based organization. Passover is coming up, as many of you know, in less than a month. And we know our history. We know our stories, we know in our traditions what it's like to be enslaved, imprisoned for profit, to build pyramids and monuments for the powerful. The Minnesota government is by the people, for the people, of the people. So if we believe that someone needs to be corrected, we believe that is a core role of our government, which represents the people and is accountable to the people in this position. As a faith-based organization, we would like to see these funds used for health and human services to promote the growth and revitalization of communities, supporting mental health care, senior health care, and other things that would reduce the number of folks heading into the prison, such as House File 2176, which Representative O'Neill outlined, and the Restore the Vote Amendment that Representative Dean offered. I just got off the phone with someone actually out in West Central Minnesota. And even though our communities are often pitted against each other in the popular media, what we found is that we actually have quite a lot in common. We want the same things, health care, clean energy, clean water. That's where we believe our money should be going instead of to support a private corporation. This bill has been sold as an economic solution, but it actually will not do that. So Passover is the story of when we were freed from Egypt, when we came out of the Exodus. So I urge this community to keep that in mind, to think about the freedom of folks. And I'm going to introduce Jim Rubenstein, who is a JCA member and who's going to talk a little bit more.
Mr. Rubenstein, with your name and title, and begin, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is James Rubenstein. My newest and most favorite title is Zadie, which is Yiddish for grandfather. I used to be a lawyer. I actually still am admitted, but I retired from the practice of law about a year and a half ago. But in my over 40 years of practice, I was a business lawyer dealing with business issue, mostly in the area of bankruptcy and workouts of businesses. And as often occurs in a bankruptcy case, sometimes assets must be sold, anything from airplanes to office furniture and sometimes whole businesses. Now, when you have to sell an asset, that drives the price down. Unless you have a lot of really willing and eager buyers, you don't get what it's worth. There's a similar thing operating here with the current version of this bill. The Commissioner of Corrections is put in a situation where he has to buy. He has to buy a specific facility from a specific vendor. That's going to raise the price. That's bad business. Now, in addition, if the Commissioner determines he needs, say, a compact car, this requires him to go and negotiate with one car dealer for one model car, which is more like an 18-wheeler compared with his needs. So that's also bad business. So in addition to everything else that has been criticized about this bill, I think it makes the state a sucker for a bad deal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. We point of questions here for the committee here before we end our meeting. Go ahead, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If Commissioner Roy could come back down.
Commissioner Roy.
I just have a series of questions, and I'll try to be brief.
I'll let the members, whatever they want to do about their presence here, they have to be places, but go ahead.
Yeah. So my understanding, the number one indicator of an individual recidivating is the inability or the lack or no visitors actually coming visiting them when they show up. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, visitation is one element of recidivating.
So as I look at the distance of Appleton from the Twin Cities area, I know we have this map on the distance from St. Cloud, but I know that most of the people that get processed in St. Cloud don't come from St. Cloud. So to Appleton from Minneapolis is 2 hours and 52 minutes. Faribault is actually 52 minutes. Stillwater is 34 minutes. St. Cloud is 1 hour and 8 minutes. And Lionel Lakes is only 30 minutes. So we're all of a sudden going to be tripling the travel time for families to come and visit their loved ones who are currently locked up. So that's one thing. Next question. Does Minnesota DOC standards deviate at all from the ACA standards for a facility?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are currently in an ACA audit mode to get all of our facilities accredited, and we have to meet almost 100% to be accredited. And we are not fully accredited in all of our facilities, but that's our goal.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about treatment and, you know, the length of time that sometimes people are there, that they can't get access to treatment. And thank you, Representative O'Neill, for her bill. Have we been increasing the amount of funding for treatment so that the DOC can actually provide treatment to those inmates who do have chemical dependency or abuse problems?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, since I've been commissioner in the past 6 years, there has been one round of a major increase. And then last year, if we consider some bills that came through with halfway house enhancement and our hub centers, that would be the second round. But we are not adequately meeting our treatment needs.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Just two more questions here. I'll try to be really quick. So I know that we did the drug sentencing reform a year ago, and there was possible more sentencing reform that was being considered as far as making the things that we enacted a year ago actually retroactive. Can you speak to the number of beds that that would have freed up within the next 3 to 6 months if we had made that retroactive?
Commissioner. Mr. Chair, Representative, with great accuracy, I cannot tell you that.
Approximately?
Sorry.
Okay. My understanding is when we're looking at the numbers, it was an additional 300 to 400 beds that would actually be freed up. And one last question. As I read the amendment, it says that the commissioner shall enter into a contract either to purchase and operate or to lease and operate an existing facility located. But it also says that, the number of prison beds to host the current or projected prison population. So in 2018, you might project overcrowding of 500-600 beds. But what if you went out to 2040 and we drastically changed our sentencing and the ways in which we incarcerated? Theoretically, you could say we're 3,000 beds over what our need might be at that time.
Commissioner. Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I tend not to think that far down the road.
Well, but this bill that we're thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go through the chairs. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. But this bill says you not only need to consider current but also projected, and there's no timeline on what that projection is. So I would assume, maybe wrongly assume, that you might do a scenario 5 years from now, a scenario 10 years from now, and a scenario 15 or 20 years from now to make those types of determinations.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our projections that we feel are pretty accurate under the current state are, and current laws are about good for about 10 years out. And if you recall my presentation, I showed the old projection pre-drug reform, and I showed the projection post-drug reform, and there was a significant difference between the two.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. My apologies for not going through you.
Commissioner, if we let everybody out of prison, we wouldn't need any, would we?
I hope that would be a drain state, and I, after 43 years doing this work, I don't think we will ever be at that point.
The Moose Lake is 1 hour and 42 minutes away from St. Paul. Is all hell breaking loose up there with the lack of treatment and SRT teams and all that other stuff?
Moose Lake is in good order, and they utilize local hospital and Duluth services.
Which I'm sure we would. All right. Any other questions? If not, we've done with public testimony. We've gone over our limit 45 minutes already. So if there isn't, Chair will...
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I just see one person who was raising his hand. Could you give him like 1 minute?
No, we've gone 45 minutes over already. So, Chair, will move House File 1510 to be held over for possible inclusion. Meeting adjourned.